I'd been preparing some statement along the lines of, "Oh God, she's gone insane, send help," but Warden's comment, closely followed by Henderson's greeting, had derailed my words on their way to my mouth. "What?" was all I could manage.
"Jack, could you do me a favour?" said the familiar voice on the phone, entirely devoid of Henderson's usual good cheer.
"Mr. Henderson," I said, trying to get things back on track,
"could you look behind you? Could you do that for me?"
I was peering over my shoulder before it could even occur to me to disobey, and I found myself staring at a blank section of bulkhead by the door, allegedly gold-coloured but more like the colour of urine.
"Why? Now look down."
I did so, straining uncomfortably. I saw only the backs of my shoes, or at least the small percentage of them that extruded from the ridiculously thick carpet.
"Yes?" "What you're doing there, Jacques, is watching your back. And I just wanted to give you a head start because you're going to be doing a lot of that from now on, by which I mean watching your back, Jacques."
"Oh," I said grimly. "Mr. Henderson, whatever Warden said..."
"Oh, don't get me wrong, it's heartwarming, it really is. You and her running off together, love triumphant across the class divide."
There was a wobble in his spiteful tone of voice that was probably more to do with murderous rage than being touched by the romance.
"I've got a lump in my throat. Have you got a lump in your throat, Jack?"
I couldn't decide what aspect of this conversation was the most horrifying.
"What? 'Cause if you do, I've got a whole room full of knives expressly designed for removing that sort of thing. Now, I know you're a man who's had a lot of empty threats, so I won't waste your time. First thing I'm going to do now is call your publisher and see exactly how much trouble I can make for you, yeah?"
I hastened to get a word in edgeways. But what about Daniel?
"Oh, I thought that went without saying. I'm going to have all my best talent hound you to the edge of the universe. And then, as long as not a hair on Danny's head has been harmed, I will make your deaths as quick as I can be bothered to make them. Oh, but I hate planning too far ahead. Maybe I'll just wing it, yeah? See you soon."
He hung up with furious speed. I grimaced despondent at the dead screen of the phone. I shared a stony-faced, tight-lipped glance with Warden.
"So embarrassing," said Daniel.
Chapter 14. "Well, thanks a plying bunch," I muttered, hands on the joysticks, bitterly jerking them like a cuckolded farmhand at the cow's udders. "For what?" asked Warden, perching on the console beside me for want of another chair. She'd only just returned from throwing Jemima and Daniel's smartphones out of the airlock, and the airlock still wasn't properly sealed, so her hair had become a lot more tangled. "Getting me caught up in your psycho-div kidnap plan? We already agreed that we both had an interest in fleeing to the Black." "I didn't agree to saying as much to Henderson's plying face," I pointed out. "And I wanted on record that I was completely against bringing the kids into this." I half turned in my chair and meaningfully caught Jemima's gaze. "Is this some kind of good kidnapper, bad kidnapper thing?" she asked, twiddling her fingers. "If it makes you feel any better, McKeown," said Warden, pushing every word out of her mouth like a bitter cherry stone. "I am the one who has flung themselves into the unknown. You are the one who has experience with the Black. I am not the one who has friends among pirates." "Friends?" I repeated. "I give them things they want and they don't blow me up. They're not on my plying Christmas card list."
"Maybe you should, you know, park somewhere and think your plan through properly," called Jemima.
Two factions had naturally formed within the bridge around the only two available chairs. Daniel was still in the captain's seat, with Jemima perched on one of his armrests. He had crammed himself aside in case he accidentally were so ungallant as to touch her posterior with his elbow.
"Ugh," said Daniel, bored. "Please don't go along with my dad's stupid plan to take over my holiday like he always does."
"I don't know, dude. I think it might be for real," said Jemima conspiratorially. "You saw how she went for your phone. She went, you know, mental."
"Dad just didn't want the surprise being spoiled," She's probably taking us to some lame pizza restaurant so he can sing Happy Birthday and be really embarrassing.
Warden watched them testily. She was holding my blaster loosely by her side. My chair was on casters. At any moment I could have made a swift kick, followed by a swift grab, and then she'd have to stop pretending to be the one in charge. And then I could wave my doints around like a big strong man before going back to doing exactly what we were already doing, because any victory I could have over Warden at this point would be a hollow one with Henderson on our tail. Like it or not, and that was a pretty huge and emphatic or not as or nots go, I was going to have to see this kidnapping thing through. But that didn't mean I couldn't grumble as I flew the ship and tried not to think about being savaged by reindeer sweaters. After a couple of hours of awkward non-conversation, we reached the trebuchet gate that served the solar system. This was the first step in getting some serious distance between us and our many problems on Earth and Luna. Trebuchet gates were the answer to long-distance space travel before quantum tunnelling came along. They were massive corkscrew-like devices that harnessed the kinetic energy from the movements of nearby star systems to slingshot individual ships massive distances within a sort of static warp bubble missile. Most of the galaxy was littered with the things. In fact, the standard definition of known space was everything within a certain distance of a trebuchet gate. They had the advantage over quantum tunnelling in that you didn't need to have another device at the destination point for them to work. You just had to be prepared for whatever unknown horrors you might end up stranded in the middle of. Quantum tunnelling could claim every other advantage, of course, like lower energy usage. A lot of space environmentalists had complained that the trebuchet gate system had accelerated the life cycles of several stars by many millions of years, and had robbed their systems of the chance of ever supporting life. And then there was the issue that trebuchet jumping was an inexact science at best, and that there were still one or two cases per year of ships being hurled directly into solid objects and being reduced to two-dimensional stains on the surface. Still, I'd always felt that the danger and gross overuse of energy was part of the romance and adventure that gave star piloting its allure. A small chance of death was the spice of life. Nevertheless, I opted not to mention any of this to my passengers. The trebuchet gate was visible through the viewing dome. I started moving us along the illuminated spaceway leading up to it, which had originally been intended to manage the queue, and which was now, of course, deserted. I was about to key into the gate's automated systems when I felt my phone vibrating in my pocket. It must have been able to refresh its battery now we were near a modern electrical system with wireless charge support. I glanced at Warden. She was keeping her eye on the kids as they took in the sight of the trebuchet gate's coiling form. I subtly nudged my phone halfway out of the pocket to see the screen. "Unknown number," it said. I made a snap decision. "Bathroom break," I said, getting up. Warden glanced at the view screen. "Can it not wait until we're out of the system?" I glanced over my shoulder when I was already halfway to the door. "Nah, it's smartest to be as biologically evacuated as possible before starting a trebuchet jump," I said. Again, it was easiest to con people with the truth. Once I was in the corridor with my back to the closed door, I took the call, holding the phone like it could turn red hot and burn my ear at any moment. "Hello? Is this Mr. Jacques McKeown, the author?" The voice was female, businesslike, and sounded slightly worried with just the mildest injection of spite. I looked back at the door for an instant, as if I could somehow see Warden through it. "Yes, that's me," I said unhappily. "Who is this?" "Emily," said the alleged Emily, as if I should have known that. "Emily from Blase Books, your publisher. I've sent you emails." "Oh," I said, nodding slowly as my eyes darted around. "Yeah, Emily." "Is this a bad time?" asked Emily. I'm fairly certain there was sarcasm in there. "No, no, not at all," I said. "What's this about?" "Is that all you have to say, Mr. McKeown? We've been trying to open a dialogue with you for years. You never reply to emails, you refuse to give us your phone number, but you're happy to give it out to some very strange man you're doing some kind of contract work for." I assembled a few puzzle pieces in my head. "Henderson called you?" "I think that was what he called himself, yes. He was really very angry about something. I didn't catch the full details. The moment I got a word in edgeways, I asked for the number he had for you."
I rubbed my eye with my free hand. Did he tell you to do something to me? Something I wouldn't like? She didn't seem to be listening. It really is very maddening that we have only now been able to talk one-on-one. It's really very unprofessional. And might I suggest, Mr. McKeown, that perhaps you wouldn't need to take contract work if he would finally allow us to pay you for... Emily, please, listen. This man, Henderson, what did he tell you to... I finally passed the sentence I'd interrupted. Pay me for what? No, Jacques, Henderson doesn't want to pay you for anything. Please pay attention, it's really very rude. We are the ones who are trying to pay you. Pay me for what? I repeated patiently. For books. Remember, those books we publish, that you write. Honestly, what else would we want to pay you for? Look, I have your number and your chip ID now. Can I just transfer the money to the associated account? Yes, I said. The word escaped before it had even had a chance to cross my mind. I was, after all, still a star pilot. But hold on. Are you saying that that I haven't been paid for a book? There were some slightly adorable shocked noises before the reply came. For goodness sake, Mr. McKeown, what on earth kind of income do you have that you haven't noticed? We haven't paid you for any books. Not until now. Every time we email, we ask for your bank details, but all you ever send to us is manuscripts. We even tried searching the bank databases for your name and address, but that came up empty. Really, very unprofessional. Have you considered hiring an agent if you're so busy? Sorry, I said, dreamily. My head was starting to spin. I leaned on a bulkhead for comfort. It's all right, Mr. McKeown, it's just that the tax people were starting to ask questions about all this money we allegedly paid you still sitting in our account. Oh, and since you're answering the phone now, I wonder if you'd like to hear a couple of appearance offers. Some of them could be really very effective. My arm suddenly lacked the strength to hold the phone up. It fell to my side, causing the call to automatically end. I'd just stolen from the real Jacques McKeown. I'd plied him up on behalf of all pilot kind. My arm strength suddenly returned and the phone came back up again so I could check the balance on my account. Then I had to bring my other hand up to swipe across because the number wouldn't fit on the screen. It was the kind of amount that makes you immediately terrified of the inevitable karmic backlash. Right on cue, the door beside me flew open, and Warden was there. Her eyes flicked from the phone in my hand to my face, and she bared her teeth. "Who are you talking to?" she demanded. Then something approaching concern crossed her face. "McKeown, you've gone white. Who was that on the phone? Henderson? You should have gotten rid of it." I couldn't help myself. Right then and right there, I had to share it with someone. It was too big for one mind to toss around alone. And Warden might have been right up there on my least favourite people in the universe list, but she was the only one who knew who I really was. Not Henderson. Publisher. Jacques McKeown has never gotten around to collecting his money. Henderson told them I was him, so they've just sent me everything they owed him. Warden's brow immediately made like a car crash. She was born of the corporate environment, of course, so this clearly made even less sense to her than it did to me. "You have stolen McKeown's royalties." "Yeah," I said. A slightly insane grin pulled my lips apart now that I had sounded it all out, and I laughed. "Yeah, that plying, story-stealing bracket, profiting off us all while we're eating out of the bins. Looks like we got the last laugh." She rolled her eyes around, thinking. "Except if what you're saying is true, he has not profited at all. He has not accepted any money for exploiting you people." A few unpleasant thoughts dropped into my mind with echoey, ominous plops. My elation was still there, somewhere, but now it felt like someone listening to very loud music at the back of a funeral service. "Yeah. But now you have." Her statement hung in the air for a moment. Then some kind of missile struck the ship, and we were both flung into the bulkhead. I laboriously disentangled myself from Warden and made it most of the way back to my console, just in time for another missile to fling me off my feet and cause my face to smash into the back of my chair. "We're under attack," relayed Jemima. She was almost fully crouched and clinging to the center railing with both hands.
Daniel was still sitting in the captain's chair, propping his chin on his hand indifferently.
Now he's just trying way too hard.
I threw myself into the pilot's seat and checked the damage report. The ship informed me, with large flashing red letters, that it had sustained damage. This plying ship had the computer interface of a poorly researched movie. But none of the major functions seemed to be damaged, and there were no hull breaches. I suspected it was a warning shot, even though such things are traditionally supposed to miss. I brought the ship around to face the blips on the radar, and saw a cluster of buff-coloured ships arranged in a threatening attack pattern. I saw two of them break from the group and move across into a flanking position, covering both sides of the route to the trebuchet gate.
"It's not pirates, is it?" Jemima allowed. "We're still in the policed areas, aren't we?"
"No, it's not pirates, it's my dad,"
insisted Daniel. "He may have a point," muttered Warden, suddenly beside me again. "Henderson will be sending mercenaries, but—" "But they shouldn't have found us this quickly," I finished, distracted by my display. I had brought up a zoomed view of what seemed to be the leading ship. It looked familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. It had the faintly organic design I associated with the just-barely-spacefaring extrasolar races, who were still more comfortable with designing ploughs and combine harvesters than spaceships. But there were also custom augmentations more consistent with human aesthetics, a sleeker nose cone, an out-of-place set of silver fins. The pilot hailed us with a video call, and an image immediately came up of a hulking figure completely silhouetted against firelight. Nevertheless, I recognized him immediately. An open fire in an enclosed atmosphere will lead to death or the need for a supremely expensive air filtration system, either of which requires a psychotic level of devotion to your image. "Angelo," I said, by way of greeting.
"Address me not by that name, steward of falsehood,"
boomed the man I had last seen getting his armour polished at Frobisher's laundry.
"Bad enough that for years thou wouldst sully the same air as I, professing hatred for deeds thou thyself had committed. Bad enough that without thee addressing me with such familiarity."
"Friend of yours," said Warden quietly, very slightly a question, but mostly identifying aloud with no small amount of relief. I was almost relieved, too. My list of potential threats had been fluctuating so wildly lately, I'd almost forgotten that all my former colleagues still wanted me dead. There was something comforting about knowing that at least one state of affairs remained stable. "Listen, what would you rather I call you, then?" He shifted in his seat, and for a moment a flicker of firelight revealed that he was leaning on the hilt of his sword.
"Address me as Nemesis, as I name thee traitor," he growled. "Address me as the avenging hammer of justice, brought down upon thee, as though all pilot kind doth hold the hilt."
Behind me I heard Jemima audibly untense.
"Oh, thank God, this whole thing actually had me going for a while. I really literally thought we were being kidnapped for real."
"I told you, it's so fake, isn't it?" said Daniel.
The emotionless blackness of Angelo's silhouetted face glared at me. I said. "Listen, Mr. Nemesis..."
"Your companions would mock me," he hissed.
All those years of hunting jungle monsters to lay their carcasses before his uninterested alien queen had made his hearing pretty sharp.
"Inform them that I would not spare thy household to reduce thee to stardust, traitor."
I shushed the children, then made a gesture with my hands as if holding up an invisible volleyball. "Okay, hear me out," I said to the unmoving black outline on the screen. "I actually have a really large amount of money." Angelo's ship, still visible in the zoomed-in view, launched a missile. A white triangle expanded rapidly, filling the view as the torpedo sped toward us. I slammed on the joysticks, and the platinum god of whale sharks, or the Jemima, depending, immediately began to speculate upon the possibility of taking evasive action. The ship's components finally reached enough of a consensus, and she began lumbering into a barrel roll, at which point an explosion in her underbelly accelerated it a bit.
"Face thy death with dignity, Jacques McKeown," said Angelo. "Do not waste thy final moments with bargains. Use them to decide which of thy many names shall adorn thy tombstone.
I checked the readout. According to the one warning window that wasn't a pop-up advertisement, we had a hull breach. It was in food storage, which was easy enough to section off from the rest of the internal environment, but most of the ship's inventory of potato chips and ice cream was now lost to the pitiless void of space. Warden took the opportunity to address the communicator. "Enemy vessel, there are innocents on board this ship."
"She's right, there are," I said, nodding rapidly.
"Thou would hide behind children," sneered Angelo. "Your dishonour knows new depths with every passing second."
"Trying way too hard,"
commented Daniel in a sing-song voice.
"It's not very realistic with the whole medieval talk thing, is it?"
added Jemima, not quietly enough.
"It's really, you know, 20th century.
"Listen," I hissed, leaning close to Warden. "Push the innocence thing. These guys are big on honour." She nodded and turned back to the communicator. "Enemy ship," she said. "Would you be willing to spare the rest of us if McKeown surrendered to you alone?" I immediately shoved her away and started making static sounds with my mouth. "Psh! You're breaking up! Stay on the line!" Then I ended the call and opened and closed my fists at Warden a few times before finding the words, "What is wrong with your brain?" "I was merely assessing all available options," she said coldly. I gestured to the ships. "Those brackets are all or nothing, lads," I said. "It's like seeking forgiveness and asking permission. They might have let you go if you hadn't been so unclassy as to ask them." Nevertheless, we seemed to have given them pause for thought. Together, we looked at the ships, hanging silently and unmoving in space. And then, after a couple of seconds' contemplation time, every single one of them started emitting volleys of blaster fire. This time I was somewhat more prepared, and the engines had warmed up a little, so I was able to use the sheer distance between me and them to anticipate where the shots were going and carefully arrange for the ship to be elsewhere. But the distance was closing fast. The Platinum God of Whale Sharks actually had a fairly competitive top speed. It was just getting there that was the problem. The thing accelerated like manure making its way out of a cow's arse. I pulled both joysticks back with one arm and used the other to set everything I could find on the touchscreen interface to maximum. I could only hope that Angelo and his friends wouldn't be able to get into close range before our speed topped out. I scanned the nearby area, nothing but space. With a few asteroids to weave around, a bit of texture, I'd be in my element, evasion-wise. Even without my usual suite of pre-programmed movement sequences, give me a few tons of rock and I could wipe any pursuer off like track on a tea tray. On a level playing field, and open space is about as level as it gets, then it comes down to who showed up in the best ship. In this case, that debate would end with one word. The word was kaboom. The trebuchet gate was the way out. All I had to do was make a beeline for it, setting its firing angle as I approached, then get ourselves launched the moment we were in range. The beauty of the system was that it was impossible to tell precisely where we'd be flung to. But before I could do that, I had to get into a position where there wasn't a throng of hairy murderers between us and the gate. We reached top speed, which was helpfully indicated by the entire ship vibrating violently and ringing with the musical squeaks and pings of screws coming undone. Angelo's little lynch mob of a fleet kept in hot pursuit, just far enough away to be the size of murderous crows on the viewing screen. I was dodging their missiles with well-timed rolls, but it was only a matter of time before that wouldn't cut it anymore. Turning at this speed, in this ship, was like pushing a boulder up a hill. But that gave me an idea. I scrutinized Angelo's ships through the rear view. They were stocky attack ships, well-armored, built for making head-on attacks and soaking up damage, well-suited to Angelo and other overcompensating warrior types, of the opinion that dodging is for girls. All of which meant that they, too, were at a disadvantage at speed. They could deliver a nasty frontal charge to get them in the thick of it as fast as possible, but they lost confidence if the charge went on too long. They couldn't maneuver well. "Hold on to something," I warned, flexing my hands like a concert pianist in preparation. I felt Warden grip the back of my chair urgently.
"You know, this is actually getting exciting," said Jemima, obediently clutching a length of railing.
Daniel grunted and swung his chair back and forth, bored.
I waited for the brief pause between volleys of missiles as the pursuers let their tubes cool down, then made my move. I put both joysticks up and the ship began to pitch forward, describing a downward arc. Just as I knew they would, I saw our pursuers begin to plot a similar path, curving downward to get us back into their sights. But at that moment I dropped our speed to zero. The ship was no better at decelerating, but its turning jets became more and more effective as we slowed, rolling us into a tight little spiral as Angelo's ships sailed away above us, no doubt wondering where the hell we'd gone. Then, when our ship was pointed upward, squat nose cone aimed at the dissipating vapor trail Angelo's fleet had left behind, I put the speed back up to maximum. That was where it all went wrong. Instead of the expected burst of acceleration, there was a smoky cough from somewhere behind us. Something important sounding made a rather distressing noise, then the engines fell silent. The touchscreen flashed red and bleeped to itself for a few seconds as I drummed my fingers on the joysticks, frozen in a dynamic piloting pose worthy of a dramatic escape. Warden broke the silence with a polite cough. "What was the plan, McKeown?"
"No one ever looks up," I muttered.
"Excuse me?"
"If we could have gotten out of their sight and ended up above them, they wouldn't have figured out where we'd gone until it was too late. Because no one ever thinks to look up. We would have been halfway to the gate by the time they realized."
"I see.
So what went wrong?"
"The engine failed."
"And why did it fail?"
I read the words flashing red before me. "Engine overheat error," it read. "Probable cause, coolant rod deactivated by user."
"It just did," I said through my teeth.
Angelo and his hunting party rose back into view like an elevator full of grizzly bears arriving at my floor. I palmed the touchscreen rapidly, but it seemed to have frozen on a red screen stating that, for our comfort and convenience, all engine functions had been disabled for cooling. I took issue with the comfort part.
"Make thy peace, Jacques McKeown," said Angelo, appearing momentarily on screen again.
"I'm not Jacques McKeown," I revealed loudly, when their missile tubes began to glow. "They're making me pretend to be Jacques McKeown, for that doint back there."
"Yeah, I knew that," said Jemima.
Daniel looked over his shoulder, wondering what doint I was talking about.
"Pathetic,"
intoned Angelo.
"Well, he's obviously not the real Jacques McKeown," said Jemima. "Jacques McKeown's, like, really rich from all the books and doesn't need to come out into the open like this."
I nodded rapidly, as the phone on which I'd seen my new bank balance started feeling very warm in my pocket. Angelo's guns still hadn't fired, so perhaps we'd at least given him a moment of consideration. The big sweaty fish was biting at the hook. It was time to start reeling. "You have to admit there's room for doubt, isn't there?" I said, keeping my face placid and tone civil, being the better man. "Whatever you think is most likely, there's at least a chance that you're about to kill four innocent people, half of them children. And then he'll be the one with no honour, Angelo." Angelo lowered his head even further and burbled out an angry, animalistic noise from the back of his throat. But it was a defeated sound. Either he'd been talked around, or the moment to atomize us all out of spontaneous berserker passion had been lost. We'd drawn it out too long. Then, a new ship screamed by overhead, mere yards from the tops of our vessels. Everyone on the bridge reflexively ducked, and I saw Angelo almost knock all his teeth out on his own sword. The newcomer then decelerated, executed a tight, flashy turn, and joined our little discussion circle, like a flashy young stud in a leather jacket arriving at the singles bar.
"It was the filth, the Interplanetary Security Service, the policed part of the phrase, policed section of space. Their ships were unmistakable, metallic blue and almost perfectly cone-shaped, the most powerful engines available at the back, tapering down to a point at the front, where a selection of blasters and torpedo cannons awaited the unwary troublemaker. They'd suffered massive cutbacks as a result of, what else, quantum tunnelling, and ever since then had had a rather psychotic eagerness to poke their noses in at the first sign of conflict. But there was something odd about this one. Instead of immediately hailing every ship in the vicinity with an ear-cracking siren and a reading of the rights, it was just hanging there in space, silent and unmoving after its flashy entrance.
I briefly met Angelo's gaze, as we both wondered where this was leading. And then a projector mounted above the ISS ship's cockpit window burst into life, displaying a gigantic holographic screen across space directly in front of its nose. An immediately recognizable face appeared, grinning, its orange skin neatly juxtaposing the ship's blue coloration. Henderson, I realized.
A good morning to you all, he said.
His voice was coming through the ship's comm system, slightly out of sync to the movement of his lips on the holographic screen.
Don't mind me if you were in the middle of something. I'm just going to sit here, murdering every single person that tries to harm Danny.
How the hell did he find us? I hissed, partly to Warden and mostly to myself. Track, he must have figured out we hadn't left the system yet. And of course we were stupid enough to just head straight to the most obvious trebuchet gate. Possibly, said Warden quietly. Or possibly it's because I texted him and told him where we were. I banged my forehead against the touchscreen as a consequence of all the strength flooding from my upper body. Why did you do that? I asked, lips deformed against the glass. Think, McKeown, Henderson's main interest is keeping Daniel safe. If your former colleagues truly intended to destroy our ship indiscriminately, then our desires temporarily aligned. Oh, of course. Sound thinking. Maybe next we could dissuade muggers by handcuffing ourselves to a Bengal tiger. I threw myself back in my seat and waved my hands manically. Hey, I've got an idea. How about we all stop ringing up the plying supervillain?
What stake hast thou in this dispute? Demanded Angelo.
Henderson smiled without humour.
I'm just a father who's concerned that his son isn't having the best holiday he could possibly have with his new best friend, Jacques McKeown.
Dad!
Screamed Daniel, covering the top of his head with both hands. Jemima, who'd been standing in front of him watching the display, flinched at the outburst.
"'Is he truly the traitor, Jacques McKeown?'
asked Angelo, jabbing into the communication screen with an index finger like a German sausage. I tried to think of precisely the right thing to say that would appease every party, but my thought process took slightly too long.
"'Oh, I should hope so, the amount he cost me!'
exclaimed Henderson, filling the pause.
Traitor certainly seems to fit the bill.
Then thou shalt bear witness to his destruction, replied Angelo, his voice descending gradually into a vicious hiss.
Sorry if I'm being stubborn, but actually, no, I don't think I will. I don't think you're going to blow up that ship. I think you're going to do that thing where you go inside the ship and take everyone alive, and then bring them to me. You're going to do that because I'm telling you to.
A few of the ships in Angelo's party were rotating slowly toward the ISS ship, anticipating a change in the dynamics of the situation.
And for what reason should we obey thy commands?
Asked Angelo, an offended edge to his tone of voice.
Boarding, that's the word I was looking for. Sorry, I've got a lot on my mind. What was that? Oh, well, let's say 30,000 of those stupid moon dollars you have.
I could still feel Warden's hand on my chair's headrest, gripping hard enough to pull the upholstery tight. There was nothing we could do but watch the exchange, like a pair of frightened kids hiding behind the sofa while their parents argue.
Begone from this place, Terran worm,
growled Angelo, to my simultaneous relief and increased tension.
There is no honour in thy grubby offerings.
The permanent half-smile froze on Henderson's face. Clearly he was used to the discussion ending after money came into it. I got the feeling we were about to see what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object.
All right. I like this. It's cute. 50,000. Come on, boys. That'd buy a lot of cheap wine and back-alley handjobs.
Angelo and the cadre of John Carter types from which he'd presumably constructed his lynch mob were a prideful bunch. Tribal living on hostile planets drums that into you. And while they were star pilots, they weren't hurting for Euro-yen as much as the rest of us. This was partly because they preferred to catch their own food, and partly because they often had side gigs taking suicidally dangerous bounty hunting jobs. And while Henderson's offer wasn't dissimilar to such a contract, they did it more for the honour and the chance to relive the glory days, not for money, and certainly not money being dismissively tossed at them as if from a strip club patron. Soon all their weapons were trained on the ISS ship. I very much doubted Henderson was actually inside it, but after Honor and Pride, Angelo's lot were pretty big on symbolism too.
"Perhaps thou should slither away now," said Angelo, "and butt thy nose elsewhere, lest we slice it from thy face for thy tone."
Henderson's smile had now entirely disappeared. He shifted in his seat, planting his chin upon his hand to regard the enemy he had just created for himself, and his bottom row of teeth ground back and forth.
"Well," he growled, "this is what happens when you try to meet someone halfway."
The screen disappeared. All was still. I glanced nervously at Warden, and she returned an identical expression.
"What happens now?" I asked.
"He's probably going to run away or start shooting," suggested Jemima. "I mean, that sounded like the sort of thing you say just before you do one of those two things."
As it turned out, she was wrong. Neither of those things happened. Instead, I noticed movement on the outside of the ISS ship and commanded the interface to zoom in. It took me a moment to recognize Carlos. It was the first time I'd seen him without his tuxedo. He was on this occasion entirely unclothed except for some kind of shiny black shorts for modesty's sake. He crawled his way along the ship's hull toward the nose cone, moving across by bending and straightening his massive arms like some kind of giant red caterpillar with a fist on each end. He paused briefly when he reached the outside of the cockpit window, then jumped. He launched himself with such power that the ISS ship was sent spinning in the opposite direction. His body sped horizontally across space, leaving what looked like a red comet tail composed of what I think might have been hairs. His target seemed to be a ship right in the middle of Angelo's armada, which, like the others, hadn't moved because they were all waiting to see where this was leading. Carlos almost missed it, but he extended a hand as he went past and managed to grab one of the torpedo tubes. He spun around it a few times, then, momentum sufficiently built up, brought one of his fists down upon the top of the ship. It went straight through the hull and up to the wrist. Then the entirety of Carlos's mass clambered inside the hole. He had a cat's ability to inexplicably fit through small gaps. On the communication window, I saw Angelo, all poise and posturing forgotten, slapping at something off-screen, presumably his own communication device.
"Brothers," he cried, "answer my call! What ails thee?"
All we could hear from our end was a combination of static and indistinct crashing and groaning noises that were equally likely to have come from comms interference, from metal being torn apart, or from people being torn apart. What we could be sure of was the look on Angelo's face, bathed in the glow of the video screen as he watched live feed that we couldn't see, and it was ghastly. His tanned complexion was turning the colour of a normal person's skin. The sound suddenly became an ear-splitting roar of wind, and at that same moment I saw Carlos emerge from the hull of the stricken ship like a jet of pus spurting from a burst pimple. He kicked away towards another target, and the ship, now empty of life, began to gently spin as it drifted away. This time the ship Carlos was streaking toward had the presence of mind to start firing, as did most of its colleagues. The area of space immediately surrounding Carlos became a confusing mess of blaster fire, torpedoes, and crisscrossing vapor trails. Carlos either took every hit and suffered no damage, or employed some arcane movements of his insane body to ensure that at no point was any part of him in any of the uncountable firing lines. Halfway to his apparent destination, his path of movement suddenly turned a sharp 90 degrees. But it didn't seem to have anything to do with having been hit by a blast, as the new path was just as straight and determined as the first. "Tell me," I said to my equally transfixed crewmates, that plying thing did not just kickflip off a torpedo." The originator of the torpedo, and Carlos's new target, registered all of this too late. The pilot made an attempt to get out of the way, but their engine wasn't warmed up. With spooky accuracy, Carlos shot straight up their torpedo tube without even touching the sides. Angelo immediately called the stricken ship,
whose pilot managed to get almost a whole word out before that audio feed also descended into loud crashes and violence. I caught Angelo's gaze after he switched the feed off. He scowled, his upper lip curling around his nose like the bread of a steak sandwich.
"You may have this fight alone, coward,"
he growled, before cutting communication. His ship peeled away from the gathering and sped off in the general direction of Ritsuko. His surviving allies quickly followed his lead. Soon our ship was alone with the ISS vessel and the two drifting ships whose pilots were now too dead to escape. Carlos emerged from the top of the second ship he had taken care of, and he clung to the hull, mournfully watching his potential targets disappear, like a child watching their mother get back in the car without them on their first day of school. Then what passed for his face slowly turned to look in our direction. Warden jerked into life. She threw an order in my general direction, "Call Henderson," and ran for the captain's chair. I hailed the ISS ship, and in the same time Carlos leapt onto that ship's hull, preparing to stepping stone over to us. The communication screen sprang to life with a new feed, and Henderson's face appeared. I hadn't been able to make out the scene behind Henderson when he'd been on the holographic screen, but seeing it on the communicator, it surprised me. He was sitting on the captain's chair of a bridge considerably more efficiently laid out than mine, and I saw uniformed ISS agents behind him, some nakedly resentful, some hovering nervously around, making sure he was satisfied with their performance. Which meant he actually was on board that ship in person. That made sense, if his bodyguard was here too. It was a risky thing for a professional in a dangerous lifestyle, and that further meant that he was taking Daniel's abduction a lot more seriously than his manner of speech suggested. I felt myself shiver with intimidation. "Henderson," said Warden. Henderson did not smile. I looked behind me. Warden was standing behind the captain's chair, holding Daniel tightly by the shoulder with one hand, and holding my blaster to his temple with the other. Daniel, for his part, was directing his usual resentment toward the face of his father. Jemima had been vaguely hovering around the room and was settled safely away from Warden, just next to my position.
"So, what's the plan, Penny?"
asked Henderson, his chummy tone of voice inconsistent with his rock-solid face.
"'Cause I can see you've clearly got this all worked out."
"Call Carlos back," said Warden. Carlos, somehow informed on the events by means I couldn't even guess at, was still perched on the top of the ISS ship's hull, watching us intently like a pointer dog. "Daniel will be returned to you when we are outside your sphere of influence, but if you make any moves against us while we make for the Trebuchet Gate, he dies."
"Oh, will you please stop it?" moaned Daniel. "We all know it's an act and you're just embarrassing yourselves."
There was an awkward pause. Then Henderson's face broke out into a wide, warm smile.
"Ah, you're right. This was all completely set up, and you're not actually in any danger at all."
"Why do you always have to mess with everything I do? I hate you."
"Oh, forgive an old man for wanting your trip to be exciting, but do your dad a favor, Danny. Just go along with it. We've put so much effort and money into all the actors and set pieces, it'd just break everyone's hearts to know you saw through it so quickly."
"Ugh,"
went Daniel, rolling his eyes.
"Fine."
"Oh my God," murmured Jemima, audible only to me. I looked at her quizzically. "It's not an act. It's all real, isn't it?" I glanced briefly over at Warden before answering. "Yeah. Is she going to kill us?" I had something snarky prepared, but then I caught the look on Jemima's face, and some long-forgotten instinct made me think better of it. "Not if I can help it," I whispered sincerely. "I'll stop it before it comes to that. Promise."
"Well then, let me just get back into character,"
said Henderson jovially. He disappeared downward off the screen, apparently rolling forward off his chair, to the confusion of the ISS officers behind him. Then he rose back into view with a face like a gathering storm. His eyes flashed white hatred from the shadows formed by his lowered brow. "Take us to the gate, McKeown," said Warden, still holding the gun to Daniel's head and not breaking eye contact with Henderson's image.
I didn't need telling twice. I slid us into forward thrust, and the ship accelerated apologetically past Henderson's ship and toward the massive corkscrew that still hung patiently in the background. I was acutely aware of Carlos's eager gaze boring into us as we swept past, ready to spring at the slightest instruction.
"Penny," said Henderson conversationally, "you're going to die."
Warden pretended she hadn't heard, but I almost heard the click of all her joints locking solid.
"I know philosophically we all are eventually," added Henderson. "I'm just saying that you probably have more reason to philosophize about that than others. We're going to find you. We'll know how far the gate sends you, and we'll find you."
"McKeown," said Warden, "do you know how to make a fire-and-forget jump?" In the back of my mind, my survival instincts immediately leapt to their feet and started swearing and banging a drum. "Yeah," I said warily. "I've never done one, but it was covered at flight school. Please explain what it is, for the benefit of anyone who might be listening." Suddenly I felt like I was back in my childhood home, relaying messages between parents. "You try to cancel out of a trebuchet jump just as the gate begins to fire. It makes the gate's firmware crash, and you get launched right as the gate starts decalibrating. There's always an element of randomness to a gate jump, but this gives it a much wider range, and it's impossible to track. So, you know what to do now, don't you?" I sighed. "I was kinda hoping I didn't, because it sounds like you want to hurl us into a completely randomly chosen point of the black." She tensed up more, if that was even possible. Her hand tightened audibly around the gun. "Are you unwilling to do it?" I turned in my chair and took the controls. No, I'll do it. Just thought maybe you might like to save a bit of time and shoot us all in the heads instead." No one replied. The trebuchet gate grew larger and larger in our view. On the video feed, Henderson watched, face still, like the crowd watching the condemned prisoner walking up to the scaffold. Then he suddenly shot forward in his seat, eyes blazing.
"How the hell do you think you're going to walk away from this, Warden? Walk away from me? You think you can hide out there, in space, of all places?"
He slapped himself on both cheeks in mock concern.
"Oh, whatever shall I do? Surely I can't just find some scumbag who'll take money to hunt you down. Who in the black could possibly fit that bill? Oh, that's right." He slapped his forehead. "Absolutely anyone."
I killed the feed. We were inside the corkscrew now, and a giant metallic spiral filled my view. The gate's automated systems interfaced with the ship's computer, and the instruction panel appeared in the middle of my screen. After setting the destination as vaguely as possible for a spot in the middle of the black, a countdown from 30 began. They had indeed covered fire-and-forget jumps long ago in my pilot training, mainly to tell us not to do them. But the trouble with teaching people not to do a thing is that you have to tell them about the thing first. So I knew that it could be fairly easily achieved by repeatedly jamming the gate's cancel button when half a second of countdown remained. I watched the numbers tick down, my knuckle hovering over the touchscreen. Said Jemima quietly, close to my ear. "Could you be honest? How likely is it that this will kill us all?" I kept my gaze fixed on the countdown. "Well," I murmured, speaking as slowly as I dared, "I wouldn't put it above 1% and below 3%.
"You wouldn't put it between 1% and 3%,
summarized Jemima. "No," I replied, drawing the syllable out a good few seconds.
"Would you put it at more than 3%?
A set of metal rings appeared around the ship and began to spin in opposite directions, knitting the warp bubble around us. My hair stood on end as every airborne particle in the ship's atmosphere held perfectly still. "Tell you later," I shouted over the growing roar of the activating trebuchet cannon before smashing the cancel button. For one confusing moment, the ship seemed to be several million light-years in length and facing in 20 different directions. Then reality reasserted itself, and we crossed the black. Chapter 15. I went through the usual disorienting sensation that accompanies a trebuchet jump. and once I'd firmly established where my body ended and the rest of the universe began, I took stock. I'd had worse trebuchet jumps. I was still sitting in the chair, miraculously, although it had rolled a good 6 feet away from where it had been previously, and there was a large, painful bruise on my forehead that seemed to correspond in size to a patch of grease on a nearby bulkhead. Jemima and Warden were both picking themselves up from various sections of floor. Daniel's chair had been heavy enough to stay where it was, so he was still in it, although it hadn't fully stopped spinning. His face looked a little green.
"Ugh," he said, it being his catchphrase. "We could have gotten, like, hurt from that. That was against, like, health and safety or something."
"Where are we?" barked Warden. I moved my chair back to the console by the traditional method of repeatedly digging my heels into the carpet and hip-thrusting madly. "Well, I can tell you it's not a worst-case scenario, because we're still alive," I said, leafing through the navigation menus. "Answer the question," said Warden testily, looming over me again. I looked at the tiny icon that represented our current location. Then I looked at the other icon indicating the asteroid belt near Cantrabarjit, where I'd last seen Den and Mark. Then I looked at the yawning black gulf of barely charted space between the two and emitted a little sigh. "We're here," I said, pointing helpfully. "We want to be there." "How long will that take?" "Assuming we aren't attacked on the way," I said.
"Well, that would just make things quicker, wouldn't it?"
asked Jemima, appearing at my other shoulder.
"That's what you, like, wanted to do, right? Join up with pirates? And once you do that, we can go home, right?"
Yeah, I said, nodding slowly. What I did not mention was that while a lot of pirates in the Black were reasonable ex-pilot types just trying to get by, it was still a very large and completely unregulated region, and some parts of it were more unregulated than others. Solar System authorities had sent a couple of census workers around the Black to get at least some idea of who was out there and what they were doing, and several of them had never been heard from again. I'd heard that one of the census shuttles had been found drifting with a load of severed limbs tied to the rear nacelles, like grim wedding party ornaments. "But if that doesn't happen, I'd say it's a 4-hour travel time," I said.
"Boring," interjected
Daniel informatively.
"I don't want to go wherever Dad's got set up. It'll be boring."
"Dude, it's not set up, it's real,"
said Jemima, desperately staring at the gun in Warden's hand.
"It is set up. My dad said it was. Miss Warden isn't even any good at pretending. She used the exact same voice when she was making me clean my room."
"Set the course," said Warden to me through her teeth. "Right you are, Mary Poppins," I replied, under my breath. 4 hours, then," said Warden, addressing the room. "We should take the opportunity to get some sleep." "I'll just nap in the pilot's chair," I said, pulling the peak of my cap low. Warden eyed me suspiciously. "Why?" "Because if we do get ambushed by something, then I don't want to have to run up however many plying flights of steps, dodging beanbags and popcorn machines to get back to the controls," I spat. "Very well," she said, after mulling it over at length. "Daniel, Jemima, come on. I'm going to lock you in one of the cabins." I interjected, as I noticed Daniel immediately perk up. "Maybe put them in separate cabins," I suggested, "so they don't conspire with each other."
"Thank you," mouthed Jemima.
Warden mulled this one over, too. "Perfectly sound reason twice in 1 minute," she said suspiciously. "Don't strain yourself, McKeown." She must have been in a good mood, or at least drifting over to the manic side of bipolar.
"I'm not going to bed,"
protested Daniel as Warden waggled the gun towards the door.
"I'm not tired. This is stupid."
"Daniel, do as you are told," said Warden, holding the gun uncomfortably. I didn't think she'd actually shoot him with it, but I wondered if she'd go as far as a pistol whip.
"Yeah, come on, Dan, please,"
said Jemima fearfully, touching his arm in a way that made Daniel's eyes bulge out like a pair of sweaty cue balls.
"I want to see, you know, what your dad set up. Maybe it'll be fun?"
"Okay,"
said Daniel meekly, reddening. Warden was shepherding the pair of them out of the room with little sweeps of the gun, but stopped at the door. "McKeown, give me your phone. We need to get rid of it before it's traced." "I know, stop fussing, all right," I snapped, Just concentrate on locking the kids up. I can get rid of my own phone. I'm not stupid. She opened her mouth to attempt some devastatingly witty response to that, but then aborted and went for a tired sigh instead. Fine, don't forget. Soon I was alone on the bridge, with no company except the background chorus of stock electronic bleeps and hums that were piped through the PA system, apparently for atmospheric purposes alone. I leaned back, interlaced my hands behind my head, and watched the passing stars until they started to lull me into a doze, and my thoughts returned to Jacques McKeown, the traitor to pilot kind believed by a growing list of people to be me, including his plying employers now. But the greatest of all sellouts hadn't reaped any of the traditional reward of selling out. I had. And I didn't want to think about whether or not this meant I had also stolen the title of traitor along with everything else. I'd just have to let that hang over me until the opportunity arose to donate it to charity or sprinkle it all away from the top of a tall building. I just couldn't get my head around why he'd never taken it. Was he just dense? He was smart enough to write the plying things and steal other people's life stories. Didn't add up. Had he been screwed by his agent or the publisher? No, the publisher had been trying to find him, and they said he didn't have an agent. Maybe, and this was getting really speculative, he just felt bad. He was just some star pilot doing some amateur writing on the side to make ends meet, and the success snowballed on him. It seemed likelier, but then again, according to the publishers, he'd never collected any money, not even from his earliest books, before he was popular as both author and hate figure. No star pilot would turn away cash. That was just a fact. We'd all gone long past the point that pride had to be sacrificed for survival. So there was always the possibility that the real Jacques McKeown wasn't a pilot. I'd almost put myself to sleep with the nice, calming background noise of constant dread when my phone burst into life, sending me into a brief seizure that almost toppled the chair. I worried my phone free of my pocket. No caller ID again. The words "don't forget" in Warden's strict tones echoed in my ears for a moment. But what the hell, I thought, she wasn't the boss of me, and there's always room to dig yourself a little deeper. I answered, "Take it you got there alive, Jacques." Still bleary from partial sleep, I needed a moment to recognize that voice that I'd heard before, but never from this phone. When I did, it sparked off a new round of seizures that sent me straight off the chair and onto the floor. "Henderson?" I said, propping myself up on an elbow. "Jacques, Jacques, we're both men of the world. Well, you're not, you live on the moon, but we understand each other, don't we?" It hit me while I was saying to Penny that thing about how any scumbag in the black would sell her out. I thought to myself, wait a minute, I know just the guy. What? Jeez, does living in low gravity make your brain float away? I mean you, Jacques. You're the right guy in just the right place to ease a concerned father's mind.
Didn't you have a vendetta against me not too long ago? Henderson was doing that thing where he appeared completely deaf to any voice other than his own.
Now, I did a little bit of thinking after our earlier conversation, and I want to float some guesswork past you. Tell me, this whole idea to kidnap my son, was that really something you and Penny agreed on, equal partnership style?
Henderson was sharp, dangerously so, like a knife hanging off a kitchen worktop in a household with young children. I looked all around before answering, to make sure Warden wasn't still hovering behind me like one of the brides of Dracula.
No, I swear.
There was a pause.
Okay, so either you're telling the truth or you're lying and you've decided you want out. That's cool, either suits me. What was it that killed the romance? Is she frigid? I'm pretty sure she's frigid.
I winced.
I'm just messing with you, Jack. That was the other thing that didn't add up. You and her running away together, you just didn't seem like her type. I always pictured her settling down with some kind of filing cabinet with a dildo strapped to the top. But anyway, now we all know where we are, I have a proposal.
Go on, I said.
Wow, you are just turning on her like a revolving door, aren't you? It's a simple deal. Turn on the quantunnel booth in your ship,
set it to the one in my spaceport on Ritsuko, let me and my boys come in and take everyone home. You do that, I wipe the slate clean and forget all about you, seriously. Next time I see a poster for your books, I'll say, who's that? Why have I never heard of such a popular and obviously extremely sensible writer?
I finally got a word in edgeways. Warden blew up the Quantunnel booth, I said quickly, uncomfortably aware that I was, as I spoke, proving that she had been extremely smart to do so. With a gun.
How on earth did she get hold of a gun?
I have no idea, I said immediately.
Actually, perhaps I should have said, how off earth?
He made a little muttering laugh at his own joke.
This complicates things. All right, new deal. I'm sorting out some scum on my end. I'll let you know where they're going to be. You just tell Penny whatever lie you need. Let the scum on board. They take everyone away. You try not to look too much like a target. And then you can go wherever you want. Sound good?
I only half heard his words because all my instincts were fighting each other inside my conscious mind. The scrappy survival instincts were all completely in favour of the proposal, but they were being fought on all fronts by the much older instincts of a star pilot, all of which were saying that, leaving aside Henderson being as trustworthy as a third-hand EVA suit, betraying a woman to the arch-villain that she was attempting to escape from was simply not what star pilots did. In response, a convincing case was made that this was a pretty sexist thought to have in a modern universe, and besides, Warden was a woman only on a completely technical level. Henderson broke my silence. He made the effort to sound reasonable.
Look, I'm offering a clean break out of this, Jack. I know it's what you want. And as long as Penny and Danny end up back with me, I could give two fetid shits for where you go after that.
I bit my lip. What about Jemima? I probed.
Jemima? Danny brought Jemima along.
He made a chuckle I didn't like the sound of.
He's coming of age fast, that boy. Now I know why her mother's been on the news so much today. Actually, that might work out really well. Hold the scum!
His last three words had been muffled, apparently directed at someone else in the room with him.
I'll let her know. She's got some clout with the UR government. Well, I say clout. She runs it.
My eyes widened like balloons attached to air tanks as I translated this in my head. Jemima's mother is the President of the United Republic, I said tonelessly.
Yeah, she's an uppity little bitch. Haven't quite been able to get her under the thumb yet. But she'll be all over this. She'll send the Navy spiels. Yeah, you know what? Forget everything I just said. I don't need to make a deal with you. You can make all the deals you like when the Navy burst in and shoot you in the knees and pin you to the floor. Catch you later, then.
After he hung up, I stared at my deactivated phone for close to a full minute. Then an actual reasoned thought penetrated the din of chattering voices in my head, and I embarked upon a short walk down to the airlock to finally get rid of the phone. On the way, I tried to focus my mind. I wasn't going to even try storing away the new knowledge that Jemima was the president's daughter. I was very firmly ordering that to the back of the queue of things my brain needed to process. The only concrete fact that mattered was that we were now on the run from the entire plying UR Navy, as well as Henderson. If either of those parties tracked down the ship and boarded it, I gave myself even odds that I wouldn't immediately be shot in the face for being too visible. That was when a plan started unfolding. Henderson wanted Warden dead but didn't seem to care as much about me. Suddenly we weren't as in this together as I'd assumed. So if I wasn't on board to be captured when the cavalry arrived, Henderson probably wouldn't give me another thought. I reached the airlock and opened the inner door just an inch to toss my phone through, receiving a vicious blast of ice-cold suction before I could slam it shut. Then I opened the external door remotely, and my only means of communication disappeared into space, along with all my prepaid minutes. That was the solution. I was already in the black. I was where I wanted to be. I just had to get off this plying ship, leave it adrift in the middle of nowhere, and let Henderson and the UR Navy scoop it up like dog dirt. Sure, it was a betrayal, but getting two miners back to their parents practically made it heroic.
If the Platinum God of Whale Sharks had had escape pods, I would have been in one already, waving goodbye to this whole tangled mess. But that was just another safety measure the manufacturers apparently felt would have spoiled the party. I'd have to flag down a pirate vessel. I was honestly surprised they weren't already circling us like hyenas, but one would show up sooner or later. Where things would get complicated would be persuading the crew to attach an umbilical but do basically the exact opposite of a boarding. They'd probably want to do the more conventional kind of boarding and clear the place out, if not hijack the entire ship, which would definitely get in the way of my plan to quietly slip away into the night. Once I was back in the pilot's seat, I devoted all my thought to the matter, there being little else to do besides watch the stars fly past, and eventually remembered that I was, as of recently, a multimillionaire. Money was the ultimate persuader. What I wasn't sure about was what kind of value solar system currency would have out here in the black, where transactions were mainly done through either bartering or theft. Still, I'd heard of arms dealers who went into the black soliciting custom from pirates, so euro-yen must have at least some value. And regardless, a million of any kind of currency turns heads. I performed a wide sensor sweep. Not a single blip. My concern for the absence of life around here was growing. But then the black was a big place, and we were currently deep in a large section of it I'd never set foot in. I usually flew tourists to Candrabarjit because it was near the rim of an outlying policed zone and conveniently close to a trebuchet gate. I hadn't been this deep in the black for a very long time. I started casting an even wider sensor sweep. I picked up a handful of populated planets within a few hours' flying range, but most of them were still around the hitting-each-other-with-swords stage of civilization last I'd heard. Humanity was still the most advanced spacefaring race, representing most of the traffic on what few spaceways had been established. Spaceways being probably an over-generous term, for someone drew a line from one policed zone to another and did a quick one-time check for black holes. Finally, I found a blip, right on the edge of the Jemima's communication range, a small vessel, but I was sure they could fit me in somewhere. I leaned close to the mic to ensure no one else on board would hear me, and sent out a standard directed signal on a hailing frequency. Hello? This is civilian vessel Jemima calling unidentified craft, I said enticingly. I dispensed with the sign-offs and official-sounding voice. The black tended to be less formal. Something vaguely communication-esque burst from the speaker, any possible sense lost in thick static. I winced, lowered the volume slider with my index finger, and messed with the frequency adjusters with my other digits. A video feed swam into focus in the middle of my view. The signal was all over the place. The interpreters seemed to be cycling through every color and shape it could think of, on the basis that at least some of them would be correct. But there was also a collection of flesh-toned patches in the middle that roughly correlated to a human face.
Hello?
Came the staticky voice. It was high-pitched and evocative of the mentally simple. Hello?
Hello?
It repeated with more confidence. Hi, I need you to listen really carefully, I said. I've been kidnapped by this crazy Terran div and she's making me fly this ship, but she's gone to bed now, and for various complicated reasons, it's vitally important that I get off this ship without her knowing. So here's the deal. If you come here, quietly, and let me on board your ship, and fly me away without anyone noticing, I will give you money. I've got a lot of money kicking around. It'll buy you a lot of goods from merchants who do dealings in policed zones. All I ask is a lift to the closest thing there is to a spaceport around here. What do you say? There was a thoughtful pause, punctuated with a clicking and humming, which was either the static or someone stalling for time.
Halo,
they said, finally. I wasn't sure how to take that. It wasn't a hostile reaction, it wasn't telling me to go and stick it, but it didn't seem to be getting the ball rolling either. Hello? Who am I talking to?
Halo?